Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Millennial Love, a podcast from The Independent on everything to do with love, sexuality, identity, and more. This week, I'm joined by the actor George Robinson, who is best known for playing Isaac in Netflix's hit series Sex Education. We talked about how George helped to shape the role of Isaac, what it was like working with an intimacy coordinator for some of his scenes with Maeve, and what some of the myths and misconceptions are when it comes to sex and relationships and people with disabilities. I should also add that for those who haven't watched the latest series of Sex Education, there are a few spoilers in this episode, so you might want to wait until you've seen the whole thing before listening. Enjoy the show!
Hi George, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I'm really good. Thank you so much for coming on Millennial Love. I'm so excited to talk to you. I am a huge fan of Sex Education. I binged the entire new series when I was very ill with this awful cold that's been going around. And no, it was not COVID. So it was great to have something to watch. Can you start off, just for people who aren't familiar with you and your story, by describing your disability and tell us what happened during that rugby game when you were, how old were you?
16, 17.
Right.
Yeah. So, where to start really, I suppose. Sport has been like a big part of my life. Just generally all my weekends were filled with, football, rugby, cross country, all of that stuff, an active young lad. I was all right at sport. I think most of it was I could just run quite a lot and large distances and stuff. So that sort of meant throughout, football and rugby, I would just run, I just fling my body at people. And when the opportunity came for me to go on a school rugby tour to South Africa, I thought, well, it's spending 2 and a bit weeks with your mates in a foreign country. It's perfect. I mean, the rugby was completely secondary, really. We went on the trip, stayed at a lovely South African family's house. And then in the game, I was on the bench. So I was very determined to not be on the bench for the next game. So I hyped myself up and just like, right, I'm going to make a big hit, make it so I'm not on the bench because it's a bit boring. So yeah, we had a scrum on our own 5 meter line, and then we kicked it out and I was chasing after the ball. The opposition caught it, and I thought it would be a good decision to just dive head first into this bloke. And then the specifics of what happened, I'm not totally sure on, but from what I've sort of pieced together, maybe is the right way of putting it, is I dove in as he was sidestepping, and what happened was my spinal column was dislocated, and the dislocation caused the severing of the spinal cord. So instantly I sort of was on the floor, not being able to feel stuff. And I remember saying those were my first few words of just like, I don't feel stuff. I've since become more eloquent, thankfully. I think stuff seemed to, get across the nature that things weren't quite right. I was completely conscious during all of it, which was a bit of a weird one because I was sort of chatting my way through breaking my neck and just not really understanding what had quite happened. I knew something wasn't quite right. I couldn't feel stuff, as I've said. But yeah, I think there was an ambulance who were there, and they sort of took me to hospital. I began to flirt with the nurses in the ambulance. Swore in the ambulance, and the coach told me to not swear. And so it was like, oh, I'm so sorry for swearing after I broke my neck. But, you know, yeah, and then sort of I remember being in the ambulance, sort of just trying to piece together what had happened. You know, you at the point, I think it was just maybe I couldn't feel stuff because of shock or whatever. And I, you know, done whatever. I was trying to piece together what had happened. And then I arrived at the hospital, and I remember seeing the physician there, the doctor, just on the door. And I asked him this question, and it was a weird question for you to ask genuinely, because it felt almost silly for saying something so, I don't know, weird. And it was just like, am I going to walk again? And he just went, right. I don't know. And I was like, ah, not ideal. And then that was the last thing I really remember before I woke up post-surgery with a few bolts in my neck.
Am I right in thinking that the character of Isaac, it kind of came about after you were cast, in terms of they shaped that role for you to a degree? Talk to me about that and how that kind of came about and your involvement in the role.
Yeah, so I think that the role of Isaac was always meant for someone with a disability. The writers have been pretty clear on that, but they were very open as to what disability he was going to have. So they basically, when the casting call went out, it was essentially just a list of his personality traits. So he was, you know, witty, sarcastic, you know, very comfortable within themselves. And yeah, he had a disability. So the audition process for the casting director must have been, you know, very broad in that sense, in terms of the different disabilities that they wanted to explore. When I went in, I sort of read it as I saw a lot of similarities between myself and Isaac. So that sort of helped me just relax into it and just go, right, this is an audition for a Netflix show. I, you know, the fact that I'm auditioning is cool in of itself. So I'm just going to go in and do my best to be Isaac. And luckily, they liked it. It was cool.
What do you love most about playing Isaac? I mean, he's such a brilliant character. Like you said, he's witty, sarcastic. He kind of takes no bullshit. He has this great kind of attitude that I think people really resonate with. And it's a really interesting dynamic seeing him and Maeve, who is also quite like a spiky character. Hmm. What do you love most about playing him?
I think it's just the self-assurance that he's got. Like you said, he doesn't take any stick. He's very, very comfortable within himself. And I feel like I've learned a lot from him in that sense of just belonging. He belongs wherever he goes. He'll make himself belong, and whether people like him or not, that doesn't seem to faze him. And I really like playing that.
And how closely have you worked with the showrunner and the people on set in terms of kind of shaping Isaac's narrative on the show and the kind of trajectory that he takes, specifically with the relationship with Maeve? Is that something that you've kind of been very engaged in?
Well, I think that the showrunners and the writers, they have their sort of overarching plan with Isaac. And I suppose that when I speak to them, a lot of it, I've had some really good conversations in terms of, you know, where Isaac's going and my thoughts on big picture stuff. But majority of the time, it's right, this is what we're planning to do with Isaac. What would be the most authentic way in order to do that, and ways in which we can explore things? Have you got any personal experiences that we can interweave into that. So, I mean, the idea of Isaac and Maeve at the top of the staircase before Isaac's Otis's party, that sort of came from my experience of just almost jokingly suggesting, just like, okay, so I've read that there's going to be a party. I remember from seeing the first series, there's a massive staircase just before the house. Like, how is Isaac going to get in? And I was like, oh yeah, we'll write that in. But they're really open to sort of suggestions, and a few, I've noticed a few times with the self-deprecating humor that Isaac has, that and it's a very, very particular thing, self-deprecating humor. People with different disabilities approach it in a different way. So sometimes the wording, they're really, really open to me just suggesting, just like, well, actually, I know exactly what you're trying to do there, but it wouldn't quite be approached in that way. So they're really open in that sense, just with the small like dialogue shifts as well.
Mm. And in terms of, and this is a spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen the latest series, but in terms of the relationship with Maeve, and there's that kind of intimate scene between Isaac and Maeve, how much of that specifically did you advise on? And what was that scene like to film? How did you prepare for that? Did you guys work with an intimacy coordinator, for example?
Yeah, so the writers have, like, you know, they're very good in terms of speaking to various charities, spinal cord injury charities like myself, and just making sure that they build up as good a picture as they can and also approach a scene like that. And there was a lot of discussions that myself, Emma, had with the creative team, just talking about the nature of that scene, because it's such a delicate moment within the story, and we just had to make sure collectively that it was right for the characters in that moment. We approached it in the right way, because obviously when you see a scene coming up, there's like, you know right, this is going to be a thing culturally just because of the nature of the scene. But you've got to, in order to do that scene correctly, you've got to completely push that out of your head. Got to complete, because otherwise you spend the entire scene just sort of looking at the camera, almost just like, look at what we're doing, aren't we great, Pat? Let's, you know, aren't we fantastic about including a scene like this? But that's just, you know, that's really annoying, and the scene wouldn't be successful. So we made sure that we just completely ignored all of that cultural significance stuff, and just made sure we focused on the story, on the characters. I'm really, really pleased with that scene. And we worked with an intimacy coordinator who really, you know, was really helpful in just making sure we felt comfortable in that moment. I think the way that Runyuraro, our director, and Ollie, the DOP, really, really helped make myself and Emma feel comfortable, and the handheld approach was really great. And it's a really beautiful scene. I'm really proud of it.
Yeah, I think it's the highlight of the series for me, 100%. And it's not just because it's something that, you know, you never see on screen, but I do think, like you said, it's really beautifully handled, and you can tell that there's a real kind of level of trust, I think, between you and Emma as actors. Is that fair to say?
Oh yeah, definitely. We had loads and loads of conversations. I mean, most of my time on set I spend sort of with Emma, so we really made sure that we both felt comfortable, and we were advocates for one another to make sure we both felt safe. And obviously when you're working with someone as talented and as generous as Emma, it makes things a lot easier.
Mm. What has the feedback been like from viewers of the show, I guess, with that scene in particular, and from people within the disability community? Because it must have meant so much to see something like that on screen.
Yeah. The feedback's been really great. Across the board, really. I think a lot of the things that I've seen, I don't really seek it out, but it's some things get sent to me and stuff. A lot of it's like, man, I really hate Isaac, but like that scene's really beautiful, or whatever. But then, yeah, it's the message that I've seen along the lines of like, wow, I've never seen anything like that before. You have really made me feel valid as an intimate being, which is it's a real honor to be told stuff like that.
In the years after your accident, do you think, how would seeing a scene like that on such a mainstream show as Sex Education is, you know, it's watched around the world, it's on Netflix, it's this huge television series, how would seeing that scene have affected you sort of in the immediate aftermath of the accident, do you think?
I'm not sure, really. I think obviously it would have helped me feel valid, and that nothing had changed, in the sense that I was still, like I said, like an intimate being, sexual being. But I think I've realized that it's a very weird thing getting a spinal cord injury, because all of a sudden you are part of a minority that you had never been part of, or whatever. I'd watch the Paralympics every 4 years or whatever, and then all of a sudden I'm sort of, you know, you're part of this minority. So what I've found, obviously, you know, with my accident and seeing a scene like that, in the, you know, 6 years since I've been injured, you know, it would have changed my mind, like just been like, wow, this is a great scene that I haven't seen before. But for also the people who have been, you know, perhaps disabled for their entire lives, and not seeing that at all for their entire lives, like I said, it's just a huge honor to have been a part of that thing culturally.
And we were talking before we started recording that Sex Education has just been confirmed that it's coming back, which is very exciting for another season. And if you can talk about this, as far as we know, you are coming back into the show.
I mean, we'll see. We'll have to wait and see.
I hope so, because I have to be honest, as a viewer, and also spoiler alert to anyone listening, but frankly, if you haven't seen the show yet, you shouldn't be listening to this episode at all. But if I was quite frustrated with the way that it ended, and the way that Maeve kind of just said goodbye to Isaac and moved to America, and then that was just it. And frankly, I thought Isaac forgave Maeve too quickly for kissing Otis. I was like, no, that's not okay. He was too nice to just be like, oh no, it's fine. Yeah, we'll be friends at some point. I left that feeling quite frustrated. How did you feel?
Well, I think that with Isaac, I wouldn't say he forgave Maeve, though. I think that, you know, he told her outright that if it's going to be a choice between him and Otis, he'd rather not. The fact that there's a choice is a problem for him.
Yeah.
So he's not going to, you know, allow himself to be messed around. And if, you know, if she's umming and ahhing, the fact that she's umming and ahhing suggests that it's not right. And I think that's one of the reasons that Isaac has become a bit more likable to viewers, in the fact that he won't allow himself to be, you know, taken for granted. And if someone's not sure about him, then that's fine. He's happy to let them go. And obviously, so far, his relationship with Maeve has been the main part of his story. But I'm sure there's plenty more to tell with Isaac.
Yeah, so am I. You just reminded me, I love the line that Isaac says to Maeve where he says, you know, that's why you give me a hard time more than anyone else, because you know that that's what's going to make me feel seen. Yeah. How much did that resonate with you personally?
Quite a lot, in the sense of, particularly in the first few years after my injury. I think this goes for a lot of people, whether you're disabled or not, is it's very easy to push people away and be, addict to people, and then people are just like, oh no, that's just how he is. He pushes people away. And if that's how you're treated permanently and you're allowed to get away with stuff, and then as soon as someone calls you out on it, you suddenly feel like you have, been seen. You're not going to be allowed to get away with that anymore. And that is just as validating as anything else. And yeah, the thing with Isaac is that, particularly in season two, with the making up of the stories about his injury, the Afghan dogs, the mysterious incident involving the wind, all of that, when that gets questioned by someone, he's suddenly, oh, okay, that's interesting. I'm not going to be able to get away with that. And that, like I said, can be incredibly validating.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What has playing Isaac taught you about living with a disability, if anything?
Well, I think it's just, like I said, that level of self-assuredness. That level of confidence of you exist. You don't have to apologize for your existence. You are a totally valid human. You don't need to apologize for your existence. Life can be just as fulfilling, as it had been, before, or if you hadn't had a disability at all. You're valid.
Watching the show, right, I've always rooted for Isaac and Maeve throughout, since he's been a character. And it was only when season three finished that I sort of questioned myself, and I thought, why does it seem so, why am I so annoyed that Maeve has gone back to Otis? And why am I rooting so much more for Isaac when, he's behaved badly too? And then I thought, is this my own sort of prejudice because Isaac has a disability and therefore I'm rooting for him more? And then I thought, well, that's quite problematic if that's where that comes from. But I kind of had to question myself a bit and think, well, why is it that I feel that way? And yeah. I wonder if other viewers feel like that, or if that's a common experience and that's what's so brilliant, I think, about the show, is if it's hopefully making people question their bias, I suppose.
Yeah, I think, that's very interesting that you say that. And I agree that a lot of the reasons behind, those things are just because of the fantastic, the writing behind the character of Isaac and that whole arc of it, because the structure of the show, the structure of the teen genre, is based around the will they, won't they of it. But then with the writers, with introduction of Isaac and then with Ruby on the other side, is that you've got such compelling relationships on either side of that structural romance, let's say, that it makes you begin, it really begin, makes you question those tropes. And yeah, I have sort of thought about like what the, analyzing the reasons and whether that instinctive, Isaac, is whether that's condescending at all in terms of, wait, why am I rooting for Isaac? Is it just because like, oh, go on, lad. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You're in a chair, you know, go on, let's give him a pat on the head. But no, it's not because of that, is it? It's because he and Maeve have a connection. And it goes far beyond box ticking because of the way it's written.
Totally.
Yeah.
I think if anything, it speaks to the lack of representation in popular culture, because I really just can't think of any other films and TV shows of this magnitude where you've seen that kind of central relationship play out between an able-bodied person and someone with a disability. Not anything recent that I've seen anyway. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
I mean, I'm not very good at watching things, unfortunately. I think everyone does. I have my like go-to comfort TV shows that I rewatch.
What are they? Is it Friends?
No. I've never actually watched Friends.
Really?
I think because my mum watched it a lot, so I've like seen bits and bobs of episodes, but I've never really gone to it. You know, I think it's like, I'm a massive fan of like British comedy and stuff, so I really like the UK Office, but then also the US Office. Always Sunny in Philadelphia is always a go-to. But yeah, I'm trying to be better and a more rounded person who watches a wide variety of things.
I mean, my recommendation, and also we'll edit this out because this is totally irrelevant, but Succession, have you seen Succession?
I need to.
That's the best thing on TV, apart from Sex Education.
Yeah, obviously. Thank you. I'm 7 episodes into Squid Game at the moment.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I've heard that's supposed
it's
to be
wild.
Good.
It's very, very good.
Okay, I'll watch that. What do you think are some of the myths and misconceptions that you notice people have with regards to sex and dating and people with disabilities?
I wouldn't say I'm totally sure. I think it's just,
I don't know. Do you think there's an assumption that there's like, you know, if you have a disability, there's therefore a significant lack of sexual desire, for example? Like, is that a myth or misconception that you have experienced or noticed people having, I suppose?
I think so. I think part of it is just, you know, I mean, particularly for me, is that I had a lot of ableism built up within myself. I mean, like I said, I'd, you know, been doing sport, using my whole body my entire life. And I think, you know, just completely unknowingly had built up a lot of those misconceptions myself, in terms of, you know, not really understanding how you know, sexual desire works for people with disabilities. I hadn't, you know, really thought about that. I'd sort of, you know, like you say, lazily assumed that you know, not that was it for them, but possibly that it wasn't, they weren't as valid an option. And I've realized that that's totally wrong. And after my injury, it took me a long time to break down that internalized ableism. But I've realized that, yeah, like I said before, is people with disabilities or whatever are totally valid, intimate beings, sexual beings, and there's nothing really different in terms of their wants and desires.
What would you like to see more of on screen when it comes to representing people with disabilities and their romantic relationships? Because I think popular culture does make a big difference in terms of tackling that ableism, because it's the closest thing to, I guess, eliciting empathy and getting people to kind of engage with the story in that way, I suppose.
Yeah, I think I just want to see more representation across the spectrum, really, because at the end of the day, people with disabilities are everything. In, like, they have their you know, their husbands, sons, they lose their jobs, they, you know, go through financial hardship, everything that anyone else would go through, someone with a disability equally goes through. So I just want to sort of see disabled people in everything, really. And then as soon as we get that, and the stories that we see disabled people in, if the story is like completely separate to their disability, then that's life, isn't it? That's, you know, the fact that I'm in a wheelchair doesn't stop the fact that I have to go to, you know, Morrison's or whatever. It's not the entirety of my being. It's just a means of transport. Yeah, I think I just want to see more.
There have been some quite criticised representations in the past. Specifically, I'm thinking of Me Before You, the JoJo Moyes book that was made into a film that paints a fairly bleak picture, it's safe to say. You know, I won't describe the plot for those who haven't seen the film, but, you know, the character that Sam Claflin plays, it's not the most... I mean, what did you think of that, I suppose? I mean, I like I said, I think it's bleak, but what did you think of that story, and also the fact that, obviously, then that instance you had an able-bodied actor playing that character?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it. I've got no desire to see it at all. I mean, I really respect Sam Claflin and Emilia Clarke in their other roles. I don't really have, you know, too much to say on that, just simply because I don't see it as a valid, you know, it's not a film that intrigues me in any way. And I think perhaps even like the it's just the ignorance of it, you know. And you just know how, you know, a book becomes popular, then the book has to be made into a movie. I think it's just the circus somewhat of the industry, just following where the money is. So I've got no ill will towards Sam or Amelia for taking that part. I just don't rate it as a story to say, because that's if the only time that you're going to make a story about someone with a disability is, you know, questioning whether anyone could ever dare to live with a disability, then it's just, all right, come on. That's not a story. I'd rather see people with disabilities existing, not in an existential crisis at every single waking moment, because that's not life. That's not something I'm interested in seeing.
Can I ask what you would like, if Isaac does return in the next season of Sex Education, what you would like for the character? Do you think that he should get back with Maeve? What would you like to happen to him?
I just want to get out of the caravan park, quite frankly. You know,
fair enough.
Yeah, just because I think he's got so much to offer the world of Moordale, and he's got chaos. He's a very chaotic being, and he has got chaos to spread throughout the entirety of Moordale, not just be confined to the caravan park. And fingers crossed for that, because there's a lot more I want to do with him.
Yeah, I agree. I'd love to see him at some more parties and that kind of thing.
Yeah, he's a chaotic being. He's fun to watch.
Yeah, agent of chaos.
Yeah.
It's time for our Lessons in Love segment. So this is the part of the show where I ask every guest to share something valuable that they've learned from their previous relationship experiences. So, George, what is your lesson in love today?
Part of it is just respecting one another's space and not feeling the need to exist with someone for the outside world. So you're with someone because you're into them, not because of the validation that being with them is going to give you from other people. Mm. You know, we live in a world with, you know, Instagram and Twitter. Yeah. If your existence is predicated on pleasing others rather than pleasing yourself and your partner, then it becomes a very shallow, superficial existence. And I think I've learned in my experiences that being in the moment and not being not living for a snapshot of you that you can post on the Instagram, the focus on the experience of it itself, that's probably the most thing.
I think it's something that we can't really talk about enough, really, because relationships for so many people have become commodities for people who have X amount of Instagram followers. You know, it's like, oh, couple goals and date night and whatever. And these are people who, you know, they'll then get hashtag gifted a date night at a fancy restaurant or whatever. But that trickles down. And we live in this culture now, I think, where, you know, people put pressure on one another to post about each other on their social media profiles. The idea being that if you don't post about one another, it's like you're not in a relationship.
And well, it's like the thing of like, was it pics or it didn't happen?
Exactly. Like, yeah.
No, it like the things you're going to look back on are not going to be, oh, that photo I took of, you know, us two wearing our dressing gowns together got, you know, however many likes. It's going to be, no, I had a really, really fantastic, you know, weekend away with you.
It's hard though. You have to actively choose not to engage in it though, because I think we're conditioned to care about that and we're conditioned to find validation in that.
Yeah. So, and I think that, you know, if that's what you want to do, if you want to post it for yourself. Don't post it because you think other people want it.
I wrote about this in my book. Like, there's a whole chapter on it called Couple Goals, where, because I just find it really fascinating, because here I am interrogating it and criticizing it, but at the same time I used to agonize about the fact that my boyfriend hadn't posted a picture of me on social media. And then it wasn't even just that, it was the fact that, oh, he posted about me on his story but not on his grid, and it's that there's a difference.
It
drives me mad. Like, I can criticize it and say it's ridiculous, but I'm culpable of it as well. So that's what I mean. You have to like
act. I think I certainly as well, in terms of, you know, there's the, I mean, we're on a process of simultaneously trying to become better people, but you know, we make mistakes, and sometimes we do wander into the self-indulgent parts of living for other people, you know, just for their validation. But yeah, I think just live for yourself, live for the people that you love. I think that's probably the main thing.
That's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. If you're a new listener to Millennial Love, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or anywhere else. Please do comment and leave us a rating too, so that more people can find us. You can keep up to date with everything to do with the show on Instagram. Just search Millennial Love. See you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.